All right, and welcome to another episode of Talking Shop Down Under. This is David Cheapak, filling in for Richard, who's on holidays at the moment. Before he left, he asked two favours of me. First, if he doesn't make it back, avenge his death. And second, to talk to the guest we have for this episode, Shridley maintainer, Yao presenter, and future Australian Test cricket captain Xerxes Batiwala, or Xerxes B, as he's known on Twitter. How you going, Xerx?
Howdy, that is a pretty good intro. Australian Test captain for sure. Better than the incumbent.
It was pretty much downhill from the intro, so it's the only bit I can rehearse.
That's it. I think the preamble leading up to this was probably the best part of the whole podcast. I'm sorry everyone missed it.
And I recorded some of it, so we'll put that on the end. Anyway, for those that don't know you, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Okay, so in a nutshell, I started my software career writing PHP back in early 2000s and did a couple of major projects for people like Sydney Water, the M5 motorway, and a few others. And then from there, got a break doing .NET development. By that stage, I'd already been doing Delphi just in my own personal time for a few years. Poor me, I hear a number of you say. So from that Delphi experience, it was pretty easy to translate over into the .NET world, where I was working on a commercial product called EDI Enterprise, which is basically a freight forwarding piece of software. If anyone knows what freight forwarding is, it's basically the software that's used by TNT and all the other major carriers who ship goods worldwide. So did that for a number of years, and then a bit of this and a bit of that, and somehow I managed to end my way up, still doing .NET, but currently at Cochlear, where we work on audiological software. So basically anyone who gets a cochlear implant, for those of you who don't know what a cochlear implant is, you can press pause right now in Wikipedia.
We'll put it in the show notes.
And welcome back. So a cochlear implant, once it's implanted, the person needs to get their specific implant tailored to their needs. So we write software that actually programs the device and gives the person their individual hearing, or specialized hearing profile. So, yeah, it's very unique, quite a different piece of software, nothing that I've really kind of ever been involved in. Certainly treads a fine line between commercialized product and kind of pats on the back, make you feel good, helping humanity kind of thing.
So your previous experience has mainly been web stuff, has it? Or?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a mix. I've had a love-hate relationship with web development. I think most people have, but my love kind of entered around the time of about IE3, IE4, IE5, when Internet Explorer was pretty much the dominant, and then tanked fairly rapidly around IE6, and when Firefox started coming out, just compatibility issues were becoming so much of a problem that I started to hate web development. Dealing with cross-browser HTML rendering was such a pain in my butt that I thought there's got to be something else, there's got to be something better, and kind of fell back onto my Windows development roots and basically picked up .NET, and from there, yeah, that's kind of how it happened. So I have been on and off with web for a while, but on the whole, I still quite enjoy doing a mix of everything.
So the question is, has WPF cured you of your hatred for web development?
Oh, I think you know the answer to that.
Leading question.
That's a dark
objection, Your Honor.
I've ever heard one.
Objection, leading the witness.
Has WPF ever helped anyone? I'm not so, well, maybe consultants, high-paid consultants, perhaps. Ouch, I just felt 1,000 claws of Redify on my back. So, no, Redify, we love you. Not Redify tag you guys. So, to answer your question, yeah, I think WPF has done some good, at least. It's kind of opened our eyes as to what can happen when you just go completely out of control, creating a framework that no one actually really has thought about how to use. So I'm hoping that the next UI platform that Microsoft create come out kind of has a bit more thought put into it.
HTML5.
Yeah. Well, I'm not so sure Microsoft are actually creating that one, but let's hope.
I'm sure they'll claim it.
Isn't that claiming it's left over for a Senate committee? Isn't that how it works? I created the internet and the tube.
Yeah, well, I started off on web development as well, and ever since doing WPF, I've suddenly longed to be back. There's some CSS problems and JavaScript issues. It just works.
Yeah, and I think there's something interesting about that. It's that it depends. I mean, I kind of have two thoughts on this. You're either really talented and creative and you like working in a front end like HTML, CSS, where it just kind of makes sense and it clicks. And I've worked with a number of people in the past who've had that nous to be able to just kind of pick it up and work with it. Or you enjoy working at the back end kind of stuff. So you like thinking about server requests and asynchronous calls and how you talk to the database and managing lifecycle and all this kind of thing. And I think I put myself a little bit more in the back end category rather than the front end. And I think it certainly works for me. You don't have to be the best at doing front end and back end, although it helps in a number of cases.
Right. So I guess we should talk about your open source project, Shuddly, which you maintain. Can you tell us a bit about Shuddly?
Yeah. So probably a couple of years ago, the awesome Dave Newman released a .NET project called Shuddly, which is an assertion library for .NET. It basically wraps up a whole lot of the NUnit stuff, like is equal to, should be this value, is assignable from, I don't know, all sorts of things, is type of. But the way that it sets itself apart from other assertion frameworks is that it characterizes itself as being able to provide meaningful output and helpful output. So a lot of the other assertion frameworks will say something like, blah, blah, value, expected this, but was this. And in a lot of cases, it's quite unfriendly, it's terse, and it really doesn't give you much context into what you're actually looking at. The last thing when you're, you know, if you're looking at a failing test, the last thing you want to have to work out are exactly the mechanics behind why the test failed. It's more about, you know, what was the test failure all about? So Shuddly tries to take it the next step and gives you a little bit more context or a bit more information about what the assertion was, why it failed, and tries to display it at least in a helpful error message.
So instead of getting expected 3 but was 4, what sort of output do you look at?
So, for instance, if your example was zombie.eatbrains should be 3 but was 4, it would actually grab the line of source that was that performed the assertion, and it would place that in line.
It actually looks at the source code, does it?
Yeah, so the way it works is that it... when the exception gets thrown, it looks back to say, okay, well, something obviously went wrong here. Let's go back to the last known point where we can start walking through the stack trace, which happens to be the Shuddly code base. And then it says, okay, great, let's find the next line which would represent the user code. Finds the line of user code. It has the metadata from the actual stack frame that represents the user code as compiled in the PDB. And then from there, it works out what line had the failure. Once it's got the failure line, it knows exactly what should assertion method you called. So you'd either be should be, should not be, should be type of, should contain, should not contain. And then it just converts the method name into human readable text and then flattens it out into a sentence. So in the current version of Shuddly, it says shuddly.chuckedawobbly : my string should be my value but was another value. And that's how it works.
All right. That's pretty awesome. Yeah, I was telling you before, so the there's a Ruby library called Wrong, which is an assertion library that does a similar thing where it looks up the Ruby source that called the assertion and tries to piece together what you're actually doing at the time. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, and it's actually really quite helpful because it gives you a lot more context about what's going on rather than, you know, the whole standard expected this but was actually that. I'm not sure if when Shuddly was written, whether it took inspiration from Wrong or whether Wrong came the other way around. I inherited the project, as I said, from Dave. He did a lot of the good work, but there's a lot of concepts in there which are actually quite unique. And I remember when he announced it to the alt.net mailing list, it kind of received mixed fanfare. Some people were quite positive and like, yeah, this actually gives us a little bit more information. It's quite helpful. I don't particularly care that it needs my source code to go and grab the context of the information that I want it needs to display. But a couple of others were like, yeah, well, it just seems like it's unnecessary and I already know what I need. So, you know, courses for courses.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the website here. It's got an example of looking at contestant points, and it's the old school message gives you sort of expected 1, 3, 3, but with 0. And using the Shuddly, it ends up actually looking up the the variable name, so you get contestant dot points should be 133, but with zero. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's exactly it. There we go. How about referring back to the website I created?
There's one you created earlier. All right, so how did you get involved? You mentioned Dave wrote it initially. How did you end up getting involved?
Well, it's funny because it really all happened quite suddenly. I was just sitting, avoiding work as per usual, on my tweet stream. This is just after Dave Newman, I think. He'll correct me if I'm wrong, but it's just after he made his quite excellent post about what's wrong with .NET. Basically offered, is anyone interested in taking care of Shoudley? So one of my other colleagues, whom we're all quite familiar with, guy with beard, Anthony Edgerton, he said, yep, sounds good. And I saw the tweet as well, and I'm like, oh, that's actually not a bad idea. Yep, sounds great. And it's kind of all just really kept rolling from there, where I just put in a few commit after commit and then started thinking a bit more about how we want to extend the framework and what direction we want to take it. And it's just grown from there. When I joined and I started having a look at it in a little bit more detail, I noticed that there were a lot of basic things that we were kind of missing. So we didn't have CI, we didn't have an automated build, we didn't have an automated deploy or anything like that. So they were kind of my first major tasks. A website for the project, all those kind of things, new Git repository or package rather. So they were the first kind of things I really wanted to get done. And amongst that, it was quite important for us to start breaking dependencies, because a lot of people were finding friction with the fact that Shoudley required a specific version of NUnit and a specific version of Rhino Mox in order to use it.
Right. So how have you found running it? What sort of time and I guess where does most of your time go? Is it on the CI and documentation, or is it in patching, or a bit of everything?
It's a bit of everything. At the start, it was actually a fair bit of time just trying to get CI running. We got onto the CodeBetters TeamCity CI server, set the build up there. There were a few tweaks and configuration issues, though, based on the way that the Git provider in TeamCity works. So ended up screwing around with that for quite some time before I actually got it to work. But, once it's done, it's kind of done, so I really don't touch it. I've just left it. I think the only thing that kind of needs ongoing maintenance now is the website. So whenever a new API is added or if it's modified, at the moment I have to modify it in two places, in the code and on the website. So I'm hoping we can borrow some of the funky stuff that nSubstitute happens to do in order to generate the website directly out of the source code.
All right, that one, it doesn't generate directly. The documentation's maintained separately, but it's compiled. So you get alerted if there's anything that breaks. So it may not help with your duplication stuff.
Maybe not. Like I said, I haven't really looked into it, but maybe something can be done. Well, certainly something can be done. If any of you out there, dear listener, would like to contribute, please feel free.
So what's on the horizon for Shoudley? Is there any new features or new releases that you've got planned?
Yeah, it's funny you mention that. At the moment, I'm actually working on removing our external dependency on Rhino Mox. So a while ago, I removed the dependency on NUnit. We were linked quite tightly with NUnit 2.6. That was internally used as the framework for performing the insertions internally. It was becoming a pain in the butt because a lot of people wanted to use a newer version or an older version, and it particularly clashed with anything that they might have had in their project. So IL merging was one option that we could have taken to do this, just bring the assembly in, but then it would still expose its types when you reference the Shoudley assembly. So it really didn't suit the option terribly well. We could rewrite all of the constraint matches ourselves and use them internally if we wanted to, but that seemed like a whole lot of work, and I didn't really feel up to doing that. I figured my time could be best spent doing other things. So one day I was just, again, avoiding work or something, and I happened to see a tweet come across from Paul Stavell about a tool that he'd released. I'm not sure that he intended it to be used a whole lot, but certainly it saved our bacon, called Tape. So what Tape does is that you feed it a C# project, it'll go through, grab all the source code, suck it into one file, and optionally, if you tell it to, it'll mark all of the members, or the classes at least, as internal so that they don't get exposed. So I thought, oh, that sounds like a neat idea. That might actually be able to help us. And that's, in fact, exactly what it did. It saved our ass. It internalized the entire in-unit framework source code into one file, and that just got plonked straight in, so we didn't even need to worry about it. And the nice thing is it's not a dependency that we really update terribly often, so the task of regenerating this tape file is not onerous. It's built into the rake scripts that we have in our build, so if we want to do it, it is just a single one-line call now to do that. And, we then took that entire code base, brought it in internally, and the compiler will obviously strip out a lot of the stuff that we're not using, and anything that we do need is already there waiting for us. So it actually saved a lot of time and worked really well.
Right, so how are you going to approach the RhinoMox one then?
Not so simply, unfortunately. So where we could get away with that with NUnit, because we were actually using a fair bit of it, RhinoMox is a different beast altogether. We only ever really use one method on RhinoMox and expose that, and that's kind of the assert was called method. So shouldly allows you to provide your mock to have a mock method, but sorry, to have your mock object, and then say assert was called, and then give it an action representing, or an expression for an action representing what you actually wanted to check. And on the whole, it works really well if you're using RhinoMox, but a lot of people have started to move away from Rhino to other, isolation frameworks. So RhinoMox itself being strictly linked is really not desirable anymore. Not everyone wants to have to package up a Rhino assembly in their project just because they need it, because they want to use Shouldly. So the intention is really to try and decouple RhinoMox altogether and have the invocation of any assert was called or should have been called methods happen dynamically. And that's kind of where at the stage where it's at. It's really hasn't been completed, but the idea and concepts are still there at the moment. So all it would do, the intention at least, is to load up the assembly dynamically if it's found, reflect out methods for assert was called or whatever it would happen to be, and then invoke that on your behalf and then pass the result back just as Shouldly always would. So as far as the consumer is concerned, there'd be no change except the fact that they get to drop this dependency. If they never call the should have been called method, then they'll never know that it could be a problem for them. And if they do call should have been called, but they don't have the RhinoMox assembly, then we'll provide a nice little message that says, hey, sorry, you can't do this. Have you tried grabbing the assembly or something else altogether?
I guess people could do adapters or something for Mocky or one of the other ones as well, right?
Yeah, so my plan is to kind of get started with RhinoMox and cut my teeth on doing this just with Rhino and then probably get something out there so people can test it. But once that's done, I would like to be able to wrap up other isolation frameworks too, like Fake It Easy or InSubstitute or any of the other ones out there.
Right.
Not that they necessarily need it, but if they wanted to, you could call should have been called on your mock you mock object or your in substitute sub.
Right.
It's all about flexibility, right? I mean, that's the nice thing about open source, that you've got options.
Yeah. Okay, so one thing people may not know about you is you do or have done a fair amount of tutoring for CompSci students at uni. What's that like?
Yeah, it's an interesting job. So one of the things that I've done for many years on the side is tutor computer science, and specifically it's been programming in either C# or VB.NET for at least 5-6 years that I can remember. The idea behind it really kind of started, the whole thing really started as a favor for someone I was just filling in, and it kind of snowballed from there. The next semester I was asked again, can you come back? We need a few more hands. It always seems to be that we run short of people and then I get the call up. So I don't know if that's a compliment or not. But
is the VB.NET thing and the running short of hands, are they related at all?
I don't think so. It's funny though that, admittedly, since last year they actually canned the VB subject. But when the VB subject was running, they always did have a pretty full class. I don't know if that's because no one actually knew whether they should be choosing C# or VB.NET, or whether they'd already maybe played around with VB, classic VB, and just wanted to try VB.NET. Who knows? But my classes were always quite full, and by full I mean I'd have usually at the start of the semester I'd have about 25 students, 30 students maybe, and invariably I think just like any other kind of uni class, there's some attrition, so that ends up being about 15, 20 by the end of time the semester comes to a close. But yeah, it's actually really quite a rewarding experience. When I started, the first thing that I really did was follow the syllabus quite strictly. I wasn't really sure what I was doing. It was the first time that I'd been teaching a class, and I figured you can't go wrong if you follow the book, even though I'd gone out of, even though I'd finished doing the same course myself only a few years prior. I figured if I did the safest thing possible, which is just follow the curriculum, can't go too wrong. And I very quickly realized that, well, actually, yes, you can. There's one thing to teach the curriculum to students, and there's another to actually make them productive and valuable in our industry. And it got to a point where I quickly realized that what we were teaching them strictly out of the curriculum wasn't making them valuable. It was just making them fairly dumb code cutters, just looking at how to drag drop components onto a form. You know, you're writing up your business logic and your data logic all in code behind those kind of things. So,
ouch. What are the areas of the syllabus, and what are the gaps?
So, the areas of the syllabus really kind of go through. Let's talk about the C# subject.
This is introductory. So this is what, first year or second year or?
So all my subjects are third year and up, or at least second year with one elective and up. You have to have done prerequisite introduction to programming and object-oriented programming, but in a lot of cases, I don't even know that the students actually did that. So I'd invariably end up with a lot of students who really had no idea about programming, what to do. In fact, in the first two lessons, I had a lot of students just boot up into Linux thinking that's what they needed to start Visual Studio. You gotta take a deep breath, bite your tongue, take two steps back and say, let's try that again, this time start in Windows. And from there, we'll take it. So you have a class that's got a really wild mix of skill sets. There's obviously a few people who have, you know, they've grown up with computers or they've just enjoyed playing with them. They know what they're doing. And I'm really comfortable just letting them go and explore themselves. Let me rephrase that. Explore the code and explore the exercises themselves and go ahead and just play with it. And then there are a lot of other people who just kind of need a little bit of guidance. Not a whole lot. They can work it out. They just need a nudge in the right direction here or there. And then there are a handful or a few that just really have no idea. And I kind of wonder myself how they get through life without being told to breathe in and breathe out. Once you get that mix, you've got to work out exactly how to cater a class for all of them, and particularly when some of these people are expecting to come out being master coders and being able to be productive in the industry immediately, it's a reality check for you as a tutor, but then it's also difficult to give them the same reality check back that, you know what, it's going to take you a long number of years before you're even mildly filled in. Well, you can't say to them that it's going to be a number of years before you're mildly competent, but it's going to be a number of years until at least you feel like you're mildly competent once you realize just how far you have to travel. And that's one thing that's difficult about it, is managing expectations. So, yeah, I've kind of lost my train of thought.
That's right. We were just talking about I was wondering, what skills are they meant to pick up just through the syllabus, and then what do you feel are the gaps that the syllabus sort of is missing?
Yeah, sorry. So what the syllabus covers are all of the core framework stuff. So for the beginners and introduction class, it starts teaching you about what are value types, what are reference types, how do you create objects, how do you create a class, how do you instantiate a class and invoke methods. really basic kind of things. And then where I think it kind of lacks from there is the right way to do those things. So, you know, about halfway through or three quarters of the way through the course, you'll be creating a Windows form application talking to a database where on the whole, you'll just drag data components straight onto the form. You'll hook them up using the connection strings and the properties designer and then set it up and off you go. And a lot of the time you're like, well, I really don't want to have to teach my kids how to do that, or my students rather, how to do that. I don't think that's kind of a good idea. So the first couple of weeks actually start learning about a console application. And in the last 2 or 3 years, I've tried to roll in my own take on how you would write a console application. So the first lesson at least starts with or the first real exercise starts with a guess the number game. So pick a number, the computer picks a number between 1 and 10, and the user has to take a guess as to what the number is. Ordinarily, you just kind of slap out, or you'd watch students at least slap out a class that's probably 300-400 lines long, has absolutely no flow to it, you can't understand it, you've got variables X, Y, Z, A, B, C, 1, 2, 3, littered all over the place, and you really just don't know what to do with it. So I really kind of hold their hand in this first instance, and I explain, look, let's start by talking about problem decomposition, because that's ultimately what it kind of comes down to. If you can decompose the problem into smaller chunks and bite them off and implement them one by one, you'll start to end up with a design that's a little bit more modular. It's a little bit easier to follow. It might not be perfect, but it's certainly going to be a lot better than the alternative. We go through probably about 3 or 4 lessons of this process. So no matter what the exercise is, we kind of talk about how we would break it down into different parts. We'd write up basically the breakdown on the whiteboard and say, look, this is how we think we're going to attack the problem. And then I kind of encourage them to solve the problem in random order. So rather than always starting at the top and then trying to work their way through the program until they get to the end, I say, if we've decided that these are all of the different modules, or these are all the different functions that this program should have, build them independently, because the whole concept is that you should be able to take these independent things, bring them together, and it's the interaction between these components that defines your application, not a giant file that has all of this code in it. And I found, and watching it over a number of years, that when students try and solve the problem top down, they'll always start with the console. They'll always start with the GUI, and you'll end up with this fantastic, pretty UI. Or, you know, in the case of a console, they'll have fantastic console text, and it's very helpful, and it says please and thank you. But then when it comes down to the actual functionality, you get null reference exceptions, or it throws overthrow exceptions, overflow exceptions, you name it. They don't get time, or they just don't put too much thought into the internals of how the application should be built, because they build from their reference point. And when, you know, if you haven't had a whole lot of experience programming, your reference point is really, what can I see? What do I want to happen on the screen? So it's very difficult to break the mentality of starting with what I can see on the screen and instead replace it with start with how you think the application is going to function, and build up those little bits individually, and then start bringing them together.
I imagine that's a bit tricky, because normally you'll start with something you can see, like your console, or if you're doing web dev, maybe your web page, and your testing is you push F5 to interact and see if you've coded it right or not. How do they sort of jump into the middle of it if they can't sort of feed in data from the console?
Excellent question, David. So also around this time that I start introducing them to unit testing or test frameworks. So most of the time we'll probably just use MS Test, because that's what's available and installed on the machines. But we have been known to just grab copies of NUnit and then run them. But the idea is, look, you don't have to write from the GUI. And if you wanted to test the function of your little bit of code without having to write a GUI component first, here's a way to do it. So we'll talk about, you know, let's create a class called a guess the number class. And when we run the game, we expect that it's going to pick a number between 1 and 10. So how do we do that? All right, well, you know, we've got this testing tool on the site here. Let's leverage that. We can create another little bit of code that actually goes and creates an instance of our game, starts the game, and checks that the random number is being created. And once they start to see that, they realize, oh, yeah, it is possible to actually go and do that and take that different approach. But without having had experience, it's quite difficult to kind of make that leap yourself. Or if you've had a lot of experience doing it the other way, it's hard to break old habits.
All right, so is that your addition, or is that something in the course? Because I remember when I went through, it was they talked about testing and you should do it, and here's the different kinds of tests, but they were sort of never mentioned again or heard from again, or they just sort of it didn't really exist outside of that.
So this was purely my addition. The course more recently has started to go into, at least in the advanced subject, has started to go into unit testing and the value of unit testing, and talks about doing unit testing in different frameworks and why you would want to do it. But it certainly doesn't go to the next level of isolation frameworks and all that kind of jazz.
It's a bit depressing that the basic testing that your code works is an advanced subject.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of depressing, and that's kind of one of the reasons why I keep doing this. That, you know,
is there a sucker for punishment?
Always. I love the punishment. But I kind of feel that no one's going to teach these guys how to do this stuff properly if everyone steps back and says, nah, I don't want to do it, or if no one who actually kind of has an idea of how to do it steps forward and says, yep, I'm going to do it. It's too easy just to follow just to take the easy way out. Ultimately, I, you, or anyone of our dear listeners over here will be working with some of these students, or will be interviewing some of these students, or will maybe even successfully hire some of these students. And, you know, if they're going out there with the badge of the university and the badge of the degree on their name, then I want to do my very best at least to make sure that they know what to expect when they're out there, and it's not about drag and dropping a data set onto your form. It's depressing how a lot of people can actually get through an entire degree with that kind of attitude. But you know, one person at a time, I'm just kind of hoping to change that.
Good on you. Well, I think we're up to about time. So
That was quick.
Besides,
not quick enough. Our listeners say, "Oh, get him off, please."
Oh, they can listen to it at double speed. So before we go, is there anything you wanted to plug?
Anything I wanted to plug?
Anything you want to plug? Maybe shouldly.github.com?
Sounds like a leading question.
This is a family podcast.
you can tell I'm good at this whole marketing business. So if you're interested in learning more about isolation frameworks that don't suck, head over to shouldly.github.com, where you can grab yourself the latest copy of Shouldly. We're also on NuGet, so feel free to grab us from the Library Package Manager. Just search for Shouldly with the little star, and that's our logo, and you'll bring it straight in. And soon to be Rhino Mox removed.
Excellent. Well, keep up the good fight against the drag and drop dataset people. And thanks for chatting with us.
No worries. Thank you for having me on.
And thanks for listening, everyone. This has been another episode of Talking Shop Down Under. And until next time, happy coding.
Visit talkingshopdownunder.com for previous shows or to subscribe to the feed. Your feedback is always very much appreciated, so get in touch and let us know what you're thinking. Reviews can be left on iTunes or the Zoom Marketplace. Email can be sent to mail@talkingshopdownunder.com and tweets to @talking_shop. That's it for now. Show's over. Go home, people. Go home.